valid. Like I say, I haven't read those cases in probably 4 or 5 years.
Okay, I'd like to call the meeting to order. All members are present except Representative Collins, and she will hopefully be here along a little later. She mentioned she had some earlier commitments and would try to make it by. I'd like to begin this afternoon's session by asking Dave Donnelly to give us an overview of the recent Supreme Court, or I guess it was a Superior Court, and you can use any one of them, decision that affects, how it affects the local hire issue and legislation. Dave?
Thank you. Chairman Navarre asked me to do a little overview for the committee's benefit of where we're at with the Alaska Hire legislation now and how it relates to the amendments that were made to the Alaska Hire Law during the 84 session, or this last session. If we go back and look at what the legislature was faced with, the beginning of the last session had an existing Alaska Hire Law from the 83 session on the books, and it was currently under litigation in the courts. And it was under appeal to the Alaska Supreme Court from a Alaska Superior Court decision, and this is the Francis case that said that the law was unconstitutional. Because it was ongoing litigation, it was deemed inappropriate, especially by the Attorney General's office, also had this opinion, for the legislature to go in and change the substantive aspects of the law that was currently being contested. As an alternative, then, it was proposed that the legislature change not the substantive aspects of the law, but the basis of the law. In other words, what the HB 294 did was amend the law without changing the actual requirements of Alaska Hire, without changing any of the existing law, by adding new sections to provide for a preamble which would have findings of fact, which were never done in 83, which extensive hearings were done, and a basic policy and purpose for Alaska Hire. If now that recently this summer the Supreme Court lifted its stay of the Superior Court's ruling in Francis, they didn't rule on the merits of the case. Their action this summer was to lift the stay, which in turn prevented for the first time the state from enforcing the 1983 law. So that as of this time, and I talked to the Department of Labor yesterday about this, Irene Platt, their legislative liaison, and the quote from her is, effectively, that lifting of the state put us out of business from an enforcement standpoint. And they're now operating on a voluntary compliance mode. They're using the people that they were using to enforce the law in a punitive manner to now ask employers to voluntarily comply with the intent of the law. So at this time we have the Superior Court decision, which rules the law unconstitutional as it stands at this time, with a pending appeal to the Supreme Court. Now the Supreme Court could at any time issue an opinion pursuant to that appeal. We don't know when they're going to do that. They haven't given anybody a clue when they're going to do that. Jandy Young, who was at the meeting this morning, told me yesterday that there was absolutely nothing new. There was no guidance whatsoever when they lifted the stay, no projection of when they may rule on this issue, and that the Attorney General's office is really just dead in the water waiting for them to rule on it. And they're not currently working on any alternatives for if they do agree or sustain the Superior Court in striking down the law. And speculate a lot of what they're thinking. We hope that they would take into account the 85 changes to the law, and once the 85 changes to the law were made, the Attorney General's office felt that the case for the 83 law became much stronger, and they entered into a settlement agreement with Francis at that time, and that was a $100,000 settlement you're probably all aware of. All parties agreed to that settlement and submitted it to the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court rejected the settlement. They didn't give an explanation on why they rejected the settlement either, other than that the matter was already passed through the Superior Court and was now before them. clearly both parties in the case thought that if the law was litigated with the new amendments on the law, they'd have a much better chance of being held constitutional. And it was clearly the opinion of the Attorney General's office. They in fact, I think, welcomed the chance to relitigate on the Superior Court level with the new amendments to the law, because they felt they had a much better chance of winning that. And also the ongoing studies. There's been a new body of research developed by the Department of Labor, and the money that's in the Department of Labor's budget now, the $80,000 approximately dollars which they're spending now to develop more statistical and demographic evidence to support the law as it exists now.
Dave, would you give us, excuse me just a minute, would you just very briefly tell us on what grounds the original law was considered unconstitutional?
Well, there's three basic provisions in the federal constitution that apply to local hire rules. There's privileges and immunities, commerce clause, and equal protection. It was under the privileges and immunities clause, I believe, that the Superior Court struck down the 1983 law we have now. The Commerce Clause has been basically ruled out by recent United States Supreme Court cases, but equal protection, which has to do with residency requirements. Often people may, probably your constituents probably come to you and say, I don't think somebody who's been here 30 days is a resident. You should make them be here a year. Well, that deals with equal protection clause. And then the other aspect is the Privileges and Immunities Clause of the Federal Constitution, which says that all the citizens of states are entitled to the same protections as everyone else. Just because you live in Kentucky doesn't mean you're entitled to protections in Indiana.
Okay, thanks.
Ron Lawrenson, the Deputy Attorney General who handled the Hicklin case back in 77, said that basically he wasn't doing anything new in the matter and that Janda Young was taking the lead, so we did check with him also. I did talk to Chuck Caldwell in the Department of Labor. Before I go into the Department of Labor, there's something possibly I should explain to the committee too. You see, in the judicial process is the role of the lower court, the Superior Court, to make the findings of fact. The role of an appellate court, the Supreme Court, is not to review those findings of fact. Those become a given. And appellate courts only consider questions of law. What this means is when the Superior Court made many findings of fact, which many people and Department of Labor believes are erroneous, because the evidence wasn't there at that time to support the state's case. That same case was tried again on a Superior Court level, and new findings made. We felt we could have won on a lot of those points that they lost on last time. But since it's now an appellate procedure, the Supreme Court very rarely dip into the facts of the case to see whether there's any new evidence, because it's already been established at the Superior Court level. And that's why the state was so eager to go ahead and settle it and then to proceed to relitigate it on a Superior Court level if it was ever contested again, because we could get new, more favorable findings of fact. Now that's a real crucial aspect of this, and that may very well be why we could lose at a Supreme Court level now, where at another time we might win, because in the beginning of the procedure we'd have better evidence at the Superior Court level, get more favorable findings of fact for the Supreme Court to review, to have as the basis of their decision of law.
Okay, Dave, as far as enforcing the local hire provision that apparently the Department of Labor is not doing now, how does that all tie in? Do we have to wait until a decision comes mm-hmm. down before they begin enforcing it again?
At this point in time, while the Superior Court's decision stands, since the stay's been removed, the law is null and void. It's voided out. It's there on the books, but it cannot be enforced while that Superior Court decision stands until the Supreme Court reverses the Superior Court or sustains it.
If the Supreme Court sustains the Superior Court, thereby striking down that local hire law, how does the changes that we passed last year in 294 affect that? I mean, then can we begin enforcing it under a new law?
Well, unfortunately, because that law, it's kind of a complicated situation. The new amendments have never been considered by the court. We were hoping, and that's what the AG's office was trying to do, is go through a procedure to get them before the court through the settlement. But since the settlement was rejected by the Supreme Court, they've never, ever had these amendments formally in front of them. So they won't be the basis of any decision. Any decision they make will most likely not incorporate those changes you made last session. Those changes were findings of fact and the policy and the goals of the legislation. They could certainly be incorporated in a new law that would be a substantive law.
Mr. Chairman, I think one of the things is you talk about it, think, in other words, 283 with what we passed last year was never even looked at. We had hoped that it would, but they just pushed it aside, said no salt. Legislatively, I have been in touch with the court and say, well, tell us what to do. If they simply, because of the reasons that Dave has said, simply say, no, the 83 law is out. I intended to reintroduce it as much the same as it was with the findings of fact on it, so it would then go into the book. So really what we did last year hasn't been challenged, but it was kind of half of it. If this half goes out, why that half by itself is just memoranda, so to speak. So my intention was the minute that they say one thing or other is to reintroduce that with the findings of fact.
Is there any chance that the Supreme Court would remand it back to the Superior Court to relitigate with the new provisions that we passed?
I would hope they would do that, but the indication that they've removed the stay would indicate otherwise. If they wanted to do that, they should have left the stay on. We're second-guessing here. We don't have an insight into their minds. They've given absolutely no indication of why they removed the stay or how they're going to rule or when they're going to rule.
If they do remand it to the Superior Court, then could we begin enforcing the law again, or would...
Well, even if they remanded it to the Superior Court, in their decision of remand, they should specify whether they're staying the court's action or not.
If we, as a legislature, repealed the old law and put in a new law, would that make the court case that's being litigated now moot? Or would they...
If the hypothetical here is there's no Supreme Court ruling on the issue before the beginning of the next session.
Right.
Well, it wouldn't make Francis's claim moot because he would have a claim based on his damages from that were suffered while the law was in effect, but it would render any further litigation on the subject moot. But I would think that the court would have to go ahead and litigate and resolve the damages due to Francis, unfortunately, on the subject.
Representative Pierce.
Dave, I'm sure you're following it closely. What's happening with voluntary compliance? Is it working? Is it not working? Do we have horror stories?
I'm not exactly sure what is going on. If there's somebody...
Yes, it's working.
Marco, do you know?
I've read some of the weekly reports.
Turn that on, sir.
I've read some of the weekly reports that come from the Department of Labor on their periodic audits of various companies around the state. And I cannot discern a pattern. Some weeks it looks like they say everybody's got 95% Alaska hire, 100%. Other weeks they report that, well, this company's got 18 non-residents, this one has two, this one has three. So they don't report it always on a percentage basis. And it's really hard because the reporting methodology has been erratic. It's hard to draw conclusions. I think there's still room for some worry.
I'd like to note the presence of Representative Collins and also Representative Snyder.
There's one real important concept that I hope, as members of the Labor and Commerce Committee, you could help educate the other members of the legislature about, and that's the amendments that the legislature passed last year were based on an existing law. They didn't change the substantive aspect of that law because there was ongoing litigation. If that law is struck down, well, then there's a lot more things you can do. because you were very constrained what you could do last session because of that litigation. You didn't want to tamper with the substantive version. Now you start, if they do strike it down, you can start from scratch and develop the, use whatever guidelines the court gives you, and all the recent cases, the cases, the Supreme Court cases, since the 83 law was written. Because you've got the Wyoming case and the preamble and the findings of fact are based quite a bit on the Wyoming case. You can use all that information to develop a new law, if you wish, and you have a lot more flexibility than you ever had before.
Representative Boucher.
Speaking of the Wyoming case, I've been in touch over the last 2 months with Alan Johnson, the senior assistant attorney general of the state of Wyoming, and he has a, you asked the question, has their law been challenged? Yes, it has. And he is sending the information to us. And he indicated a willingness to work closely with us in providing such information because he feels that there are parallels. So I, by the same token, have sent a packet back to him on it. So they have offered the help on it, too.
Representative Pinalbe.
Mr. Chairman, for the, you know, this is a workshop, and for the benefit of the members, I hope I'm not being redundant, but I think something that Dave just said bears some emphasis, and that is that the reason why we took the approach last year on 294 and 295 was because the state was in the middle of litigation. The reason I bring this up is because the legislature as a whole is criticized, and people wonder, why can't you guys pass a decent local hire law that works when, you know, you just passed one last year, but already we're getting the Francis Robinson decision that's going against local hire, so whatever you guys did in January doesn't work. And I think it's important to remember and to let your constituents know that the reason why we really didn't change the substance of the law last year was because of the pending litigation. The Attorney General didn't want us to change the substance of the law for fear of admitting weakness in the law and in effect abandoning the case. The legislature would kind of say, look, we don't have any faith in our case. So instead of changing the law en masse, the suggestion was to change the findings, come up with the findings of fact, and that's what 294 did for us. We didn't change the law because the AG said it's probably not a good idea. Most people don't understand that. You know, most people just figured, well, here, I know the legislature did something last year with a local hire law, now the courts come out again this summer. It's another bad ruling. It must mean that the legislature didn't do their work last year. That's a little bit of a complicated circumstance, but I think it really bears explaining to your constituents. I have found a lot of raised eyebrows when I've explained this in the groups I've taught.
I talked to Chuck Caldwell in the Division of Research for the Department of Labor yesterday, and he's the person in charge of spending that $80,000 that's in the Department of Labor's budget to do the research into the Alaska hire demographics. I thought the committee would be very interested in knowing that their current projected time of completing their study is the end of January. And I was a little disappointed because I was hoping that you'd have the information before you began the next session. I don't know if there's any chance of speeding up the process or not, but I thought you should know that they weren't planning on that information being available to you till the end of January.
What was the name?
Charles Caldwell. He's the head of the research for the Department of Labor. Apparently, right now, they're undergoing, and the vast bulk of that 80,000 is going for just computer time to run the match on the permanent fund dividends with certified payrolls. Those certified payrolls would be mostly on government projects, jobs where they have enforcement officers there. That will prove real interesting what that evidence produces. If there's money left over, they may proceed to other studies. But it looks like they really came in with a $100,000 budget. They only got $80,000 to do these studies, and it's money looks real tight just to pay for the computer time. to do all these matches. They're performing like 72,000 records per month. They're checking permanent fund dividend applicants versus the people actually listed on certified payrolls and public works jobs. It's interesting to note, too, that we ought to have a much better picture when that's done, because one of the specific rulings in the Superior Court in the Francis case, the court that found the finding of fact, was that there was no evidence that just because because there's a large amount of people from this state making unemployment claims from outside the state, that was no indication that those weren't residents. In other words, the Superior Court judge said that he wasn't convinced that just because people made a claim from California on unemployment insurance they earned in Alaska, that those weren't Alaska residents. Well, hopefully these checks will confirm that, because one of the other runs they're doing now is a check of the permanent fund dividend applicants versus the people who claimed from out of state for unemployment insurance. Alaska is a very, very high ratio, especially in certain industries, of people claiming from outside the state. And it just would seem logically, and that was the argument the state made, that logically that would indicate that we've got a lot of non-residents working public works jobs up here. But the court wouldn't agree with that. They said the evidence wasn't sufficient. So once this computer match is done, there should be no question one way or the other whether those people are residents or non-residents, because I don't think the court could say that very many residents of Alaska aren't getting the permanent fund dividend.
Representative Pierce.
If the Supreme Court throws out the law, then we get to start over. In the Wyoming case, as I understand it, only applies to state-funded projects, and says that there has to be a preference first for residents, non-residents. There's no training involved, and so on and so forth. Just preference. Is that what you would making this leap of faith, that that's where we might be able to start? Is that what you suggest, that we would might be able to enact a law successfully that just was for state-funded projects, or are there other opportunities out there? And if so, what are some of them?
Well, there's two levels to attack. I think the law we've got now is the first step. My personal opinion, if we don't win on the public works construction projects where we're using state dollars for these jobs, we don't have much of a chance beyond that realm. I think you've got to take that as the first step. Senate Bill 271 and Representative Penelberry has a companion bill on the House side deal with work done on state land as another rational basis for requiring local hire. That's a little bit further reach, right? I'd like to cement the first step, requiring local hire on public works projects before you reach for state lands. Also, hopefully, if they do strike down the law, they'll give us some guidance about why, and we'll be able to compare with what they asked for versus what we already have now that we didn't have when it went to Superior Court, and that will give us a much better picture. There's also a lot of creative things you can do that have never been done, and that's requiring localized areas to have a particular percentage of unemployment, sort of a kick-in clause, before the law would take an act. There's nothing like that now. That would make it more narrowly defined and remove the overbreadth problem that the Supreme Court talks about so much. That's dealing with the problem, preventing jobs to people who didn't necessarily need the jobs prevented because of what your goal is. You're trying to go as narrowly as possible within the Constitution. You can discriminate, but you must do it as narrowly as possible to reach your goal. And overbreadth means that the states used a scattergun instead of a rifle to get there.
Representative Collins.
Okay. I have it appears that we have a real problem in terms of getting a law that's going to be unchallengeable and that really is going to meet our goals. I was wondering, in light of this, at the present time, are there any incentives given to employers to employ local people? It would seem to me that if we did that, and that perhaps we could have two things going for us, eventually some incentives and the law. And I'm wondering if that approach has been tried.
There was one proposal before the Resource Committee last year that dealt with the fishing industry and a tax incentive for a local hire. They wanted some tax credits to develop some processing plants out there, and there was thought given to putting a local hire clause in there that the people who would comply with local hire would get be have it available for them. That seemed like a real original and good approach. And I've been informed that Department of Revenue has just very new draft, a draft of legislation that would provide tax credits for resident hire, but I'm not familiar with that yet. I'm sure they probably wouldn't even be amenable to letting it out to public. It's just a draft.
Mr. Chairman, I was thinking along those lines, and my thought was that for any state-funded project, that a contractor would have to post a bond of, say, $100,000 or whatever in order to be able to participate in the work. And then if he used, if he demonstrated that he used Alaska Hire, the bond would be either not required or significantly diminished. And I'm wondering if that would be constitutional. And that's kind of what I had in mind, was to do some things. So, and an example to say that anybody who could demonstrate that they used Alaska Hire, then it was okay for them when they bid to bid 10% of somebody else, and they would still be considered, you know, type of thing. Would that be unconstitutional, or would that raise an unfair practices or interference with commerce?
Yeah. Generally, a real good rule to use when you think of the Constitution is if you can't do it directly, you shouldn't be able to do it indirectly, because if the rule's the rule, then just going through technical ways to get around it really isn't fair. And hopefully courts see through those things. But if there's a legitimate purpose for doing what you do, if there's a legitimate commerce reason for doing what you do, well, then you're going to have a rational basis for the law. Then you've got a much better chance of success. So, as it is, if the law is wiped off, if it's ruled unconstitutional and needs to be revised, you'll be able to start fresh with all kinds of new ideas like that and work towards those goals. Developing a rational basis and making the appropriate findings of fact to support that basis, which the process the legislature went through last time with 294.
Representative Boucher.
My concern in this, and as I said, I guess I've been living with this now for about 15 years, is to get something on the books that the court says is constitutional. It's kind of like getting to first base. If that's all I can get, I want to get, but I am just bound and determined if they don't come with it, we're going to go back, because there is, I believe, it is constitutionally valid to seek employment for Alaskan skilled who are unemployed versus the non-resident who's equal. It's just, that's just a fairness issue. And we get wandering too far on the thing. Now, it's been said, well, you know, why don't you overreach on the thing? Because I have been there before. I sat there at the table when we instituted the Alaska Hire Law and the Hicklin-Norbeck case. You know, if there's nothing else I'm aware of, it's that. And I feel deeply that we can get a constitutional law. And I felt that when Dave and I talked about this a considerable amount as we drafted and talked to the Attorney General's office when we were putting the law together, we didn't want to get too big with antennas sticking out all over it. We had to indicate in our testimony and everything that we were trying to say, court, Wyoming says this is a valid goal, Camden says this is a valid goal, other places there are precedent, would you look at it? But really, right today, they said, hey, too late, I'm not going to look at it. So I am not discouraged by it, although, as Marco said, it came out and they struck down the 83 law. The average person who is reporting on this really doesn't understand that, much less the public. What we did last year hasn't been scrapped unless the court comes out and says that 83, but I think it's rather unlikely. I think we're going to have to take what we had before, put the findings of fact, and run that through them and say, now what do you think? We are hoping that the court will give us some indication, and that's where the frustration exists today. Over the past week or two, we've talked about the possibility of writing a letter to the court, you know, saying, hey, give us some guidance. When do you intend to come down? But this is kind of a touchy area. So what I'm trying to do is probe around the edges by maybe talking to an Art Snowden or somebody else and say, well, you know, can, is there, on a one-to-one basis, without violating the sanctity of the court. But I think we can. I still believe today we can come up with a constitutional law, and so do other people that are dealing with it. Now, whether it's going to cover everything that everybody needs and wants, and we know what that is on the state leases, I don't know.
Roger.
Yeah, not to interject my own comments here, but speaking to this whole issue of trying to get the courts to tell us what they see as where we should go, Representative Gruenberg came up with a possible solution to this. I understand he's been in contact with Representative Boucher about this. There is, in your packet already for Representatives Davis and Kopanen, a substantive statement to that effect, and I'm circulating a slightly more detailed one here that's strictly a draft. Representative Gruenberg just wanted the committee to see it as one means of maybe getting the courts to tell us what is wanted or needed. I think it focuses most specifically in on the percentage issue, and I believe Representative Pignalberry may have further comment on that, but Representative Gruenberg asked me to present this to the committee, and so that's what I'm doing here.
There's a certain amount of precedence for this approach in residency, particularly. The court has adopted different residency requirements that's under the equal protection part we discussed earlier for different types of purposes. For emergency services in a community, you can't discriminate almost immediately between new residents and old-time residents. Yet for college tuition purposes, to determine who's in-state and who's out-of-state, you can take a much longer period of time for discrimination, require much longer residency. So that some states have adopted laws where they say, well, we are going to require the maximum residency that's constitutionally permissible. Hopefully the court will tell them what that is for that particular item. The problem is that the courts don't always tell you what they want you to do, what they figure is appropriate.
Representative Pignalberry.
Mr. Chairman, first, before I talk about Representative Bloomberg's bill, I had a conversation with him yesterday that I'd like to relate to the committee. I want to go back for a moment to the Department of Labor Research Division that's doing that analysis on local hire. I have visited down there with the Director Caldwell and the supervisor for the project and the guy who's actually responsible for doing the keyboard work on the computer analysis. And what they're doing is they're using a computer that is funded by the federal government for wage and hour work. And the law requires that any time they use that computer for something other than the federal program, they have to reimburse the federal government. And it's an expensive mainframe computer. And I'm impressed with the innovation of the people in that division. What they've done is they've gone out and bought a small computer. They're downloading information from the mainframe, you know, one chunk at a time, and they're analyzing it one chunk at a time, and they're going back and taking more off. Now, they've got an $80,000 budget, and the point that I want to make, and I've got to make it again to the governor, and I hope everybody here would, is if this issue is so all-fired important, why the hell can't the state find more than $80,000 to come up with a database that will, number one, defend us in court, and number two, help us grasp the depth of the problem that we're really dealing with? $80,000, it's nobody's fault here that we didn't get more money through the legislature. At another time we could talk about what the problems are in the finance committees of both houses, primarily the Senate. But the governor surely ought to be able to find another $20,000 or $30,000 to complete this analysis on time before the legislative session in January. And at this point, I think that's probably all it would take is another $30,000 or so. And I'm reading in the newspaper every day where he's saying how important resident hire is. But he's not taking any action. I think a little encouragement from this committee would be in order.
I'm kind of between a rock and a hard place. If you read, there's a guy named John Boucher that's doing the work on it. That's my son. And I was the one that recommended he load it down into his micro. It's stupid, you know. You can pull that stuff up at 4,600 watts, or suck all you can off of it and then play with it. And that's what they're doing. But to the 20,000, this 20,000 was appropriate. It is floating around in the Department of Labor. Somebody took my money or what have you. What they need to do is get their administrative act together.
With the concurrence of the committee, I'll have a letter drafted to the governor asking him to see if he can't funnel some dollars to this program so we can get this, try to expedite it as much as possible, so we'll have that data information.
That's a motion, I'd so move.
Without objection?
Department of Labor did, they expressed concern that they did lose a couple weeks between the fiscal years when they had the appropriation in their budget, and they scrambled and did find some money to begin the project before this fiscal year started. They didn't tell me exactly how much that was, but I know that it slowed them down a little bit there.
Representative Pierce?
Is any of their problem a manpower problem, Dave, or is it all money for the computer time?
I got the impression it was money for the computer time.
Okay.
That they're really going to burn up a lot of this just doing that, and they have to limit. They'd like to do one project right before they plan to go to the second one. And they're looking, they might use up all this money just for this one project.
But it's not manpower.
I don't think it might be.
You could do the work a couple different ways. You could get a programmer in there to work with just the mainframe and do all the work on the mainframe, which probably is the more expensive way to do it. Or you could probably buy another small computer and get a second person in there to do the same thing that the person that's downloading and analyzing it now is doing, to just make it go faster. I don't know really which is more cost effective.
These people have to be computer programmers?
No, as a matter of fact, they're using Lotus or, you know, common off-the-shelf programs. They're not using anything fancy.
Well, if they've got these people who can't enforce the Alaska Hire Law right now, and we have people who are supposedly doing voluntary compliance, they've obviously got 8 or 10 folks who probably aren't 100% effective right now because they don't have a job to do. Why can't those people be used?
We ought to ask the Department of Labor that.
Mm-hmm.
With the concurrence of the committee, we'll draft a letter to Commissioner Labor and ask him if they can't move this up more on their priority list. You know how the departments prioritize. They don't like to be, I guess, have their priorities changed by the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
But that's our job.
Correct.
Well, the final point I'd like to make to the committee is, as far as I know at this time, nobody's working on alternatives for what should be before you next session if, case A, they sustain the Francis, the Superior Court, or case B, they strike down Nobody's working on alternatives, and there's a lot of different things that can happen. First of all, they could say the law is constitutional the way it is now, in which case you might want to consider going on to the proposition in SB 271, which is to extend to Alaska lands, state-owned land. That might be the next step. Or if they strike down the existing law, where do you go from there? There's all kinds of ways to proceed from that point, because you'll be starting fresh again. You won't have the existing law to constrain you, which we had last time. There'll be quite a few different alternatives. So there's a lot of different possibilities out there, and nobody seems to be doing anything on those at this time. This proposal from Representative Grunberg is a very interesting concept, but I don't know how well it will address exactly what the legislature itself is looking for at this time. You're going to need some sort of substantive basis for it. It'll work fine if the court comes in with a percentage ruling, but I think it's highly unlikely that they're going to say that the law you have on the books for 95% would be fine if it said 50%. I don't think that's the way these laws run or fall. I think they run or fall on the basis, the factual findings, the overbreadth question, and how narrowly tailored they are to meet the goals that you say you're trying to meet. So I don't know, this would work perfectly if they do come back and say, if you make it 50%, we'll buy it. But I don't anticipate that happening. The Attorney General's office has said to me, and Jan DeYoung has mentioned to me, that for the AG's office isn't at this time devoting any time to that because they're really involved in the current case and they're waiting for a ruling. Once they get the ruling, they'll hopefully have some guidance. But they're not taking the political realities into consideration when they're saying that. I agree with them that it'd be more efficient to have the decision before us, just as it would be more efficient to have the United States Supreme Court decision definitively addressing the issue before us now, too, which we may get from the Wyoming case. But the political reality is can we afford to wait another 2 or 3 years, and what jobs we'll lose over that time? Or do you have the time next session, when you're going to be very concerned with money matters, to begin from scratch a month into the session developing a new Alaska Hire Law? And those are all questions I would throw out for reconsideration.
Roger.
Just speaking on Max's behalf, it was my understanding when he explained this to me that his specific intent with this language that he drafted up was to try and get the court to come back with a specific percentage that they would feel was allowable. Whether that's really going to take care of the whole problem or not is a different question, but that was the intent of what he was trying to do here. And he indicated no particular pride of authorship, so that if we wanted to include this in as part of a larger package of things we're doing as a committee, then he'd find that acceptable.
You and I have talked about this thing. It's a question. It's my number one priority. I've been reading and reading and reading. I don't have anything down on a piece of paper yet, but I damn well intend to introduce a bill. I'm going to keep trying on the thing. I'd like to go home and finish it all out and know that there was one in place constitutionally. I haven't, as you and I have talked about. I said, well, let's put something down on paper. Let's write a letter to the court or what have you. I'm sure Marco feel this frustration, he and Joe, on the thing. Maybe what we ought to do is just all get our acts together on the thing and decide the direction in which we want to go. I've been associated with the beginning. I don't have to come out with another one, another bill. Maybe it can be a committee bill. It makes no difference to me, but I think we do have to get one. But aside from that, I am going to work on legislation on that and the things that we're doing in telecommunications.
Representative Calgary.
Mr. Chairman, the draft that Representative Bloomberg was given, I went over with him yesterday, and we talked about it on times previous. And I think it's a good approach. My basic reaction is, as I've mentioned to him, is that I think the more legislators we can get involved in the issue, introducing bills, the more clarity the message will be received amongst the employers of the state of Alaska. And I encourage any innovative, different approach. My comment about this specific approach is that I think, like Dave was saying, the question is not the percentage, the question is the principle. Mm-hmm. If we're just arguing over the percentage, I think it would be a much narrower question before us. But I would rather win it on the principle, because once you win the principle, you can go for 100%,
mm-hmm.
although I don't think that's realistic, I'm saying you could. But I would not, I don't think the court ought to say that 50% or 70% is the right percent for local hire. Because where do they get that number from? And if it has to be changed, on what basis are they going to be changed? I think that would be a real interference in the executive branch's prerogatives. But I'd rather try to win it on the principle. And I think it's winnable on the principle.
And a real important factor that I explained earlier is that this court may be very constrained on a percentage, too, because they'll be saddled with the facts from the superior court level. They won't be making new findings of fact unless they open it up for new findings, which they haven't done. So you may not want this particular case to be the one that sets the percentage, if there is a percentage set.
Mm-hmm. Representative Pierce?
Perhaps we should, in our letter to the governor, request from him an overview of what he intends to bring to us at the beginning of the next session, and also put him on notice that we will be working as a committee and as individuals to have some alternatives ready to go in January too, so that he'll know ahead of time.
Take some action and find a few dollars to help out the department later. But I've not communicated with the governor about what kind of bill might come out in the next session. You know, I was hoping that that maybe I'd learn something here from the committee about what you plan to do with the court. I see the court as a real obstacle here, and not being an attorney, I'm less worried about trampling on court procedure. I look at the court system as a co-equal branch of government, and I think I ought to be free, or any member of the public ought to be free, to correspond with the court and to give them my views on public policy, just like I am with the executive branch or the legislative branch. And not as an attorney, not as a party to the case, perhaps, but I think when the court's action or inaction is adversely affecting public policy, then it's up to those of us who also have an interest in that public policy to let them know that, hey, you know, we're waiting on you and the interest of the state is not being served by your inaction. And I've talked this over with one other Senate member who is an attorney and who thinks that that might be in order. But I know some of the other members of the bar that are in the legislature say, oh, no, you never want to do that. So, you know, again, it's fools rushing in where angels fear to tread. I think I'm going to communicate with the court.
The committee may be interested in the fact that talked about this with Representative Boucher before. In some states, the legislature is allowed to certify questions to the Supreme Court. In other words, they vote as a body and say, we would like you to tell us what your best guess is, how you would rule on facts X, Y, and Z if we pass a law. And they send it over to the court. In Alaska, that's not the case. There has to be a matter in controversy for the court to take an action or make a decision. But that doesn't really deal with or prohibit members of the public sending the court letters on policy matters that are not dealing with specifics.
I guess along the same line as Dave's saying, I think the committee and I, everybody is stymied until we get the court decision, right? It seems to me that a couple days after the decision was rendered, we've had time to analyze it. I'd hope the committee would get together and figure out the next step legislatively. You can't really do that until we hear from the court.
There's no time frame for a court decision?
I talked to Jan DeYoung. She said it could come down after next session even. I mean, there's no constitutional or statutory requirement that the court make its ruling at any particular time.
We need to address that.
They're a co-equal branch, mm-hmm. and there's no way you can really direct them to do anything they don't wish to do in that order. The only thing that could be being done, which hasn't been done, before the court makes its decision is to start doing some basic research on the issue of where you want to go with a new basic Alaska higher law if it's necessary. That could be started, so you would have that background to use as a basis for the specifics the court gives you in guiding towards a new law.
I had considered that, except that then wouldn't it be a little bit contingent on just what direction the court did give you? I mean, you'd be working in an ocean rather than a lake?
I think, Mr. Chairman, we have a real good idea where they're probably going to go. And the direction, my own personal hope is what they do write in the decision will allow the legislature to fine-tune what we already know to meet their own requirements for this state and what their interpretation of the federal constitution is.
Are we in a situation where our friend Mr. Zobo has promised to go to court on anything we try to pass, no matter what it happens to be?
Mr. Zobo was counsel for Francis, and Francis agreed to settle this out of court and to wipe out the Superior Court decision. And the amount of the settlement was the $100,000. that would have put us back with a good new Alaska, with the old Alaska 83 law, with your new amendments on it, and if it would have, and it didn't seem to me like it was his intention, although I can't speak for him, but if I was going to settle a case, I wouldn't want to wipe out the advantage I had of having the old Superior Court findings of fact. It wouldn't be logical to want to do that and then go and relitigate again. I'd want to win with what I had because he was in the most advantageous position possible at that point, having the Superior Court ruling and findings on his side, yet he chose, or at least his client chose, to settle at that point.
As far as the options go, if we write or attempt to write a new law and make it cover the other areas, that such as leases and things like that, then if we take the law that we have now, the 83 law with the findings that we put in last year, and then add these other sections on, what would that do to a challenge to the overall law? I mean, then would it have to be challenged by section, or would that weaken a particular section by having, I guess, it broader in a sense by going into the leases and things like that, as far as like public construction, what we're talking about now, public construction dollars? Would the other sections that we would write into a law, expecting maybe that they would be challenged, would that weaken the public construction area?
This proposal from Representative Gruenberg is very effective in handling that problem. I think section 2 here, where it says, should any provision of this section be declared unconstitutional, the remainder shall be upheld to the maximum extent permitted. That, I would think, if you choose to make a composite law where you have one findings of fact, as you've already established, plus whatever new findings of fact, and I would certainly suggest that you have new hearings to receive the new Department of Labor evidence next session and add those to your findings. Plus, then you could have a section that had a public works local hire section, and then you could go on to a section similar to SB 271 in the House bill. What is that number? That would deal with oil and gas lease lands or state-owned lands, and then have a clause like this at the end, so that if they found that only the state lands portion was unconstitutional, they could strike that down and yet sustain the constitutionality of the public works portion.
Are there any questions or comments from committee members?
This is Representative Copeland in Fairbanks. It occurred to me that one of the questions that we might research goes all the way back to the Orbeck case. One of the comments by the U.S. Supreme Court was that obviously the problem was that we had too many Alaska Natives who didn't have the training, and therefore the law wouldn't really solve the problem. This, of course, was not really true at that time, because there were quite a great number of natives who were active in the various skilled trades at that time. In fact, one of them was head of the carpenters union. It seems to me, at least it came to me at the time that I was working for the Human Rights Commission, that at least percentage-wise, the number of Alaska Natives working in the construction trade and the skilled construction trade has, at least to the percentage, declined since that finding. And that itself may be an interesting finding, exactly what has happened since the, historically, over the last 20 years, and whether in fact, the throwing out of the original Alaska hire provision may not have rebounded against minorities in Alaska, and that might give us another lever to work on the entire problem. The second aspect is the hiring of people attempting early entry into the trade, and specifically speaking of, let's say, high school graduates and early college leavers in the age from 18 to about 24, our unemployment rate and our entry into the skill trades at that level is, I think, lower than you find in other areas, precisely because many people find it better, obviously better, to hire somebody from out of state who has some experience than to go through all the problems of hiring someone on an entry level and training them, regardless of whether the pay scale is that much different. So I think that certainly young people, regardless of their ethnicity in Alaska, are suffering from the current law. So those two aspects, history of minority hire and the history of entry-level young people in this state, the percentage of the labor force, may give us some interesting information for legislative findings. That's all.
I think this next session, you may just, I'm just projecting ahead here. I think a very important issue you may be dealing with will be the distinction between Alaska hire and local hire.
Mm-hmm.
I think it could become very controversial. And I think it'll be important to distinguish between the two issues. They're very different indeed. One requires the person to be a resident of Alaska, and the other may require what requirements you want us to place or allow communities to place to require that people who work on projects in those communities be residents of the communities. While the precedents are intertwined, at the same time they're very distinctive precedents on both levels, and the policy issues are different. And I certainly hope it doesn't become a conflict between the bush and the urban areas over this matter, and Alaska Hire would suffer for that. Because I think all Alaskans benefit from Alaska Hire, and I think local hire is a separate issue.
I think you misunderstood my point. I am not trying to talk about local or bush hire. I'm saying that as a result of the falling off of Alaska Hire, in other words, the Orbeck decision compounds the problem of local hire, but it itself has been, in fact, the Supreme Court finding may have been an actual cause for the problem that we now see as local hire, which had a removal of them. So I think it's very intimately a part of the major case.
Yes, I agree with your point, Representative Copeland. I was just following through for the committee's, hopefully, just kind of trying to look in the crystal ball and see what you're going to be faced with next session. I think also that there would be a substantial body of evidence to show that some of the Native corporations have made a concerted effort to try to educate their people. I don't know if they're being employed or not, but to educate them in oil and gas type technology jobs. And we may be able to create a better factual, to refute what the findings of the United States Supreme Court were back then, maybe in our favor. I don't know if they're being hired for those jobs, but I think they're trying to train their people to do those things now.
That's very true.
Are there any other questions or comments on the...
I just have a comment on something that Marco was saying earlier, and I appreciate him following up on sending the telegram to the governor regarding drafting of the leases and language in the leases. And I did mention that again to Mr. Wanneke about what took place in our meeting, that is trying to get some language in those leases that we put a little teeth in there rather than just, as he said, milk toast. Or, I've heard worse in terms of descriptions of it, of the language of the leases. And she, apparently there's someone within DNR that's working on that, and that might be something that the committee could do also, in addition to writing a letter to the governor, write a letter to Commissioner Wanneke, maybe with a carbon copy to the governor, indicating that the language in those leases should have something much stronger than what's currently there. And I'd like to make a motion to that effect.
Okay, if there are no objections, we'll do that also.
Also, Marco, you said you get a daily or a weekly bulletin from the Department of Labor regarding the amount of non-residents working in different firms around the state. Did you say that?
Yes, Mike.
Can I, who do I get on, talk to you on a mailing list on that?
We could have, see, Dave just gave me a name, Irene Plate. 465-2700. She's the commissioner's assistant for legislative affairs. And I think that's who got me on the mailing list.
Yeah, great. Thanks a lot. I'll try to get on this. That's all I had. I just, as we had a discussion on this whole issue of leases and with the oil and gas committee, and I agree. The next time I talked to Esther, I mentioned it to her, and she was going to check on, well, maybe a letter from the committee would be another indication of the need for them to do something about it.
Mr. Chairman, one final thought might be, I think the testimony of the Department of Transportation this morning kind of pointed out some interesting things. It seems to me like their job is to do their projects as economically as possible and do as many as they can with the resources they have. It just seems like a bureaucratic difficulty. It's just a function of our particular bureaucratic form of government. I think that different departments have different primary goals. And there doesn't seem to be anybody really, you know, coordinating Alaska Hire efforts or any one person responsible for seeing that all the bids that go out have as much as possible or as favorable as possible to Local Hire or Alaska Hire. It seems just to be lost somewhere in the bureaucratic haze there. And I don't know what the answer is, but it's certainly something the committee might think about. Maybe we can come up with some creative responses to that type of just bureaucratic problem of how to promote that so that all the agencies coordinate on the issue.
We just have to make it state law, and they will.
Representative Boucher?
One thing that we pointed out at a hearing that was held in Fairbanks on the Alaska Hire, that last year there were 700 and some odd contracts let that required Local Hire enforcement. Now, the first thing it requires is the municipality or the state agency to notify the Department of Labor, Wages and Hours within a specific amount of time that the contract has been let. Of the 700 and some odd contracts that were let, only 400 state and municipal agencies complied. So the greatest offender was right within our own government, and it was often on these jobs for $200,000 or $300,000. The people come in, the work was done, and by the time Wages and Hours could check the thing out, they're already gone. So there's an awful lot of sloppiness in this. Different sections within the Department of Labor look at it differently, and I think that right now, while there is a concern for Alaska Hire, that as was pointed out here just a moment ago, that there's nobody that's looking at the bigger picture. And if we, the state, let millions of dollars slip through our finger, either by sloppy contractual procedures or failing cities and entities failing to report, then it becomes a pretty difficult case to sit down to the industry and ask them to do something. So one of the things that I thought early on that we should do is really police our own backyard. And it is a matter of record that was brought to my attention, the facts that I stated here. that we indeed weren't reporting the contracts. And the law, we're talking about the law specifically required that they do that within a certain period of time.
Representative Pierce.
Dave, I keep going back to this because I'm a little confused about it. Under the Constitution, under the privileges and immunities in the other two clauses that we have problems with when we look at Alaska Hire or local hire or any other kind of hire, has there ever been a case where a state or a government entity had a contract like we were talking about, or bid specs like we were talking about this morning for the prison, where they were required to hire local people or state people? Has there ever been a case where that was questioned, and if so, what was the decision there? Or conversely, on, say, an oil contract, and I was not here last week for that oil and gas hearing, but if we're telling Commissioner Wanneke that we want to see specifications in the leases that say that there has to be Alaska Hire, is that going to stand up? Can it be written such that it will stand up?
I'm not familiar with the United States Supreme Court case that dealt specifically on the facts with a bid specification. We had a municipal ordinance in City of White case, which is what the 83 Alaska law was based on. That came out about 81 or 82, and that's what the 83 legislature used as the basis for the 83 law. Now, right after they passed the 83 law, they had the City of Camden, a New Jersey Supreme Court case, which was appealed up to the United States Supreme Court. And that was on a New Jersey, or I think a City of Camden ordinance. And it was, that's where a lot of the guidance that wasn't used for the 83 law is available now, where the court said they wanted to look at the facts of the case to see what the unemployment was in the City of Camden, how narrowly tailored the law was to address that problem of unemployment. And they didn't rule on the issue. They remanded it to a lower court for further findings on those facts.
Okay, so we are presumably not just shooting in the dark if we say that from now on any royalty contracts for oil and gas would have to include an Alaskan hire provision of some sort.
Well, unfortunately, that sounds an awful lot like the 1977 Hicklin case dealt with that.
Okay. Well, then I guess I would direct this to Mike Davis in Fairbanks. Mike, how is it that the committee decided that they were going to be able to require the commissioner to do this?
Well, Drew, I wasn't real specific in the language, but what happened until, I think it was around 83 or 84, they required, as a provision of the leases, for the people that have the leases to turn in reports on who's working for them. There was a pretty strong language saying that where feasible, where possible, last people would go to work. And also they would have to turn in employee records stating where the employees were from. And I don't think that's unconstitutional. I think we could at least require that the development of leases that they turn over that information to the Department of Labor, so we can get some kind of sense on what who is working on the leases. That's all I'm saying that we can do now, and that's certainly within our realm of power. The reason they stopped doing that because they didn't see any reason to collect the information anymore. It was unconstitutional for Alaskans to be required to develop leases, so why collect the information? I think the information is needed, and so we might as well require it, and also have language in there stating something a little stronger than when possible for the lessons to work. But that's all I'd like to see done on these leases, and if we can do more, let's do it, but I don't think we can do it at this time.
Okay, that was just misinterpretation of mine of what Representative Pignalberry had stated here. I thought he meant going even another step further than that. Before the Labor and Commerce Committee wrote a letter to the governors and to the commissioner, I wanted to make sure we weren't jumping in with both feet all the way up to our knees and on something we can't do.
Yeah, good point.
That seems to me like a perfect example of one department not understanding the issue and dropping the ball in the case, because I think we've had a lot of legal opinion that while we might not win on an oil and gas lease or state lands law, there's certainly different facts now than there were in 77. And for one department, just by fiat, decide it's not important for them to keep those records anymore, when those records could be the very key to supporting or be the foundation for a new law that did require Alaskans to be hired on the North Slope in those jobs. That just goes to show the lack of coordination we've got right now in government.
Steve, I agree with you, and I've been talking to Kay Brown since about 82 of the need to have some, you know, just because we can't, just because the law is unconstitutional, doesn't mean that that information isn't real valuable, whether when we're sitting down talking to all companies, we'll have the facts in front of us. So totally agree with you, and I'm glad we've got all these people that are speaking from all different areas on the need for local hire and the need for different firms throughout the state to hire locally. We're obviously getting some people's attention, but I agree with you. Let's write that letter and let's see if they can finally do something about it.
Are there any other questions or comments on the Alaskan hire?
Well, this is one point, rather interesting. As you know, I worked for some time as an investigator for the Human Rights Commission on the pipeline-related cases. And our human rights law creates various classes of protected citizens who cannot be discriminated against in hire. Regional sex, ethnicity, etc. But it turns out that there were, at the time of the pipeline construction, some firms from outside, principally those engaged in pipeline welding, who had a policy of discriminating against Alaskans. Exactly what that was based on, maybe Alaskans were too loudmouth or something, but I investigated a number of those cases and attempted to get the commission to defend the people who had not been hired or had lost their jobs because of that they happened to be Alaskan residents. The problem was, of course, that the statute did not cover them. It occurred to me subsequently that in cases like that, maybe it wouldn't be a bad idea to have the Human Rights Commission at least defend the rights of Alaskans to apply for jobs in Alaska on an equal basis with some of the people that the outside contractors bring up to them.
Just for the committee's information, that's a very good point raised by Representative Copeland, and he also raises an interesting aspect. When you think about this, there's a concept of discrimination. I think a vast number of the citizens of Alaska, the voters, the laypersons, don't understand the concept of discrimination adequately to really understand how it relates to a local hire and Alaska hire. I know Representative Copeland understands it from working with the Human Rights Commission, but as certain forms of discrimination are appropriate, are allowed. It just have to be within the Constitution. The word discrimination itself is not prohibited. The act of discriminating, it's improperly discriminating, is prohibited. And there's certain areas that the court have said, if you discriminate, we're not going to allow you to discriminate at all on the basis of race. That's out. But if you discriminate on the basis of, say, somebody's size, it's going to have to be rationally related to the job you want them to do, and so forth and so on, depending on the form of discrimination, whether the rational basis bears a more or less stricter scrutiny, so that when you see the ordinary person on the street and they say, well, the word discrimination has a very evil connotation, it sounds like something that's like taboo, it's not necessarily true. We discriminate every day in our lives. It's just, do we do it rationally and fairly, or do we do it improperly on basis we don't want to discriminate? And so that's important.
The experience is the one that really comes to mind right away. When you're hiring somebody, you want somebody who has been trained in the specific job you want.
But that's a concept I really wish we could get out to the people so they would understand it better when they thought about the whole issue, because I think the way people think about issues is real important to the eventual result.
Maybe I'd throw in just my two-bit experience, which is another complication of this whole puzzle, which is I worked on operating engineers on the pipeline, and they had a pretty good record of hiring locals, but then you start getting into subtler types of discrimination, which is all the operators that ran the equipment were from outside unions, and the locals that they hired were all people that were the oilers who were getting about $3 or $4 an hour less. And there was definitely any attempt by an oiler to move up to be an operator was met with he would get fired, and how do you prove what you really got fired for was because you were trying to move up in the ranks or what have you. It wasn't that hard and fast, but there was clearly a pecking order that was developed, and even though on the books operating engineers could show, well, they were really doing local hire, there's a real question as to just who was getting the good jobs and who wasn't. So that's a further problem that needs to get looked at too.
I couldn't get a job on the pipeline.
You were
that's
too
real
young.
Discrimination.
It was age discrimination. He was too young.
Are there any other questions or comments on the Alaskan hire issue? Basically, what I just wanted to do with this was get an explanation of what the recent court ruling meant, and I guess have some discussion on what our options are going into the next session. And I expect, although no commitment at this time, that we'll have, if the Supreme Court does hand down a ruling, then we'll have a Labor and Commerce meeting shortly after that, depending on our schedules. And even if they don't, there is a possibility that we'll have a meeting later this fall to discuss more in depth what our options are going in the next session. With that, we touched on plumbing code legislation yesterday, and I expect what I'll do is first I'll explain what happened last year. There was apparently some miscommunication between the Senate and the House as to who was going to be involved in the negotiations regarding what would be or not be in the plumbing code that we passed. And I had thought that the Senate was going to work out a compromise, and that never happened. So we didn't deal with House Bill 63 much last session. What I'll do is begin working on some type of a compromise between the various interest groups, and I guess let you on the committee know what, I guess, direction I'll be taking on that. I'll probably try to pattern the bill, House Bill 63, or the amendments or substitute to it along the same lines as Fairbanks and Anchorage Municipal Codes. And I guess as we go through that process, I'll keep you informed of what's going on, and I'm certainly would appreciate any information that or input that you have on that bill.
Chairman Navarre, my interest in that would be to separate some of the different types of material used and make the ones that are generally safe the approved ones. I know I have problems even with the old plumbing code. I don't think that, for example, it still mentions the use of lead pipe, and I see that completely struck out, even though you can't even buy it any longer because of it. The danger of lead poisoning, the old code actually still mentions it. I think one of the problems I've seen with the code is it's completely within the trade, and there hasn't been enough work with, in one case, firefighters, and the other, public health people, to make sure that all of the aspects are are dealt with, and I'll be interested in what kind of stuff I can come up with. As I say, I hope that we can discriminate between the usable and unusable plastics and metal because of the health and safety factors.
I remember it also mentioned asbestos cement pipe.
Right.
So it's, as far as that goes, I guess I'll let you know what's going on with that. It's something that I'd like to see taken care of early next session, or at least begin with it early next session, because I expect that whatever we do on the House side is going to be redone on the Senate side.
Isn't that always the case? Mm-hmm.
Insurance, we discussed yesterday a little bit too. I think we're all aware of the problem that has surfaced, particularly this year, with insurance in all areas. I believe due to budget constraints, we're not going to have time or money to address it again later this fall, but what we'll try to do as a committee is set up early next session some expert witnesses, both from the industry and Division of Insurance, and the Department of Commerce, and other areas, set up some expert testimony so we can hopefully get a better grasp on just what causes the problems and what we can do to address it. And we'll try to set that up for early part of next session. Timeshare campgrounds is something that was brought to my attention that I really haven't looked at up until now. We have some information in your packet, and Alice, did you want to address that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just looking over the notes here that are included, and I appreciate the time that your aide, Mr. Roger, put into getting a lot of this information. My preliminary concern was brought up by a constituent or someone I met at a picnic who asked about this recreational opportunities at opening a, kind of a timeshare campground or a thousand trails sort of deal in Kenai. And it was my intent at that time to find out if this was legitimate, to find out if indeed this particular company was operating in other parts of the United States. There had been some indication that in Portland there were many of these who turned out to be people selling these deals, getting money, and then pulling out. And this was an older man here in Anchorage who had some concerns that perhaps, you know, this company might be up here in Alaska attempting to perhaps swindle some people. Anything that Roger was able to find out and that I could ascertain from him was that this was a legitimate company. I think in the process of that, he determined that even with that new Condominium Act, was it Senate Bill 44?
44, yeah.
Yeah, that I assume that probably this would be addressed. And I think that he determined it is not. There's a loophole that would allow, indeed, companies to come to Alaska and perhaps maybe not as reputable as this particular one. So I think that was why he pursued it, and there were some people in the Attorney General's office who were interested in this and wanted to write up some draft legislation. So I think that's kind of where we are. Maybe when he comes back he can expand on that a little bit. The thought was, you know, maybe as in so many cases, I think I'm always amazed at the sophistication of people who are out to defraud the public. And it seems that, you know, once they become aware that there is not legislation, that there are not laws in place to keep some of these things from happening, that you become fertile ground. And so I think the only, not that this was a big pressing need, but I thought maybe it would be nice just for a change to perhaps get some legislation drawn up before we have the problem, and maybe to have something online. It's not anything of great controversy now. It seems like this one company that has come in is legitimate, but that's not to say that perhaps once it started, I think this is the first one, that maybe others won't follow and some of those intentions might not be as honorable.
Roger, has the AG's office drafted legislation on this timeshare, or is there some model legislation?
No, what you have in your packets is a draft law that they put together that Rob Mintz in particular has worked on. It focuses fairly narrowly and specifically on the campground issue. We had talked at some length, and there's extensive backup in your file on the whole chronological order of how this developed that indicates that they could, with some problems in terms of the language, expand this to include a possible bill that would be more encompassing and bring in recreational facilities in general, like racquetball clubs and what have you. But for the time being, they focused in on just the campground issue. And that's my request, because they were moving this way anyway and felt that it was a valid problem area and that it might have more success going through, for some of the reasons that are in your packet, have more success going through as a committee bill through us rather than them trying to propose it through the governor's office.
Representative Hanley.
A question, Roger. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's my understanding that this particular that membership camping would not be covered under any present legislation on Senate Bill 44, that comprehensive condominium legislation that we passed last year. Is that correct?
From what I understand in conversation with Mr. Mintz, that is correct, that the Senate Bill 44 last year really deals with timeshare issues, and this membership campground is not, I mean, that's why in the places where I believe I referred to it in various notes, I put timeshare in quotes, because you're really not sharing or owning a facility in common. You're only sharing a use of a facility in common, and so it isn't really covered, as I understand it, under SB 44.
Review this. I guess my interest would be that perhaps, you know, if after reviewing it and at the next meeting of Labor and Commerce, if we meet again before the session, and it sounds like we might have at least another meeting, you know, to get things lined up for the session. After members have had a chance to look at this and I've had a chance to look at it, I'd be interested in knowing if this is something that we'd like to consider proposing as a bill from Labor and Commerce. If not, you know, I think I indicated to Roger, I thought it might be worthwhile to consider it, and I'd look at it individually, but I'd be happy for us to look at it as a committee bill, just to fill in one of those loopholes.
Thank you, Representative Hanley. That would be what I'd like to do, too, is have some more time to review it, and then we can either address it if we have another committee meeting or else at the start of the session. I'm still checking on our funds to see how much money we have available in our budget.
Okay.
I think we were one of the smaller budgets.
Well, I'll chip in and give you gas money to drive up here.
I would too. We have a fundraiser.
Yeah.
The governor's expenses.
Yeah, the Labor and Commerce.
Republicans for Navarre.
Yeah.
Except somebody would use it against you in the next election, might give it enough.
They'll use it.
Libertarians would use it against you, probably.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay. I thought maybe you'd had it and I had it and
no.
I hadn't looked at it, but I feel better about that.
My apologies to the committee members. I only just, I've been trying to pressure the Department of Law into getting a draft of this to us in time so the committee could review it, and I only just got that submitted to us just yesterday morning, so that's why I didn't have time to mail it out to everybody, but the backup material is pretty self-explanatory. And once you review through it, you may even be interested in some of the possible spin-off legislations that tie into this, such as the Green River laws, which I was surprised to find out, I assumed, and a lot of Alaskans assume, are in effect in Alaska, which limits or disallows door-to-door solicitation. And apparently there's no such law in the books in Alaska. So I don't know whether the committee wants to, you know, trail off, or somebody is interested in following that up further. But there were several little spin-offs from this key issue here dealing with campgrounds. Now, the other one I already indicated, which is to expand it to include all recreational facilities so that it becomes something that the urban legislators might be interested in, as well as the more rural legislators where the campground facilities are.
Mm-hmm.